Okay, thank you guys for coming back in. We got a lot to cover here in the next 45 approximate minutes, and I'll do my best to get through it. Lots that I want to try to relay to you and help you with. this is entitled, this section, Loving Better, and now we're going to get into our human relationships. There's a few things I just want to read to you. I just found these in these studies recently. Is feeling alone the greatest health problem Americans face? While the obesity epidemic has long been front and center in major cities across the U.S., and it's an epidemic, overweight and obesity, it's an epidemic. If you combine overweight with obesity, 70% of Americans, including children, are overweight and are in a bad situation. The obesity epidemic has long been front and center. New research finds that loneliness and social isolation is an even greater public health threat than being overweight. Dr. Julian Holt Lundstedt, a professor of psychology at Brigham Young University, conducted two meta-analyses of previous studies to determine how social isolation, loneliness, and living alone plays a role in a person's risk of dying. Being connected to others socially is widely considered a fundamental human need, crucial to both well-being and survival. Extreme examples show infants in custodial care who lack human contact fail to thrive and often die. And indeed, social isolation or solitary confinement has been seen and used as a form of punishment. Yet an increasing portion of the U.S. population now experiences isolation regularly. In an analysis of 148 studies that have included more than 300,000 people, her research team found that a greater social connection cuts a person's risk of early death by 50%. There's been studies not done really, some of them, to be honest, intentionally, because if you thought they were intentional, they're really incredibly cruel, of little babies, areas where they've had orphanages where they only have so much staff. And so one group of babies got daily care. They got their diaper changed, obviously. They got fed, but they also got held a little and talked to by a nurse, human contact. And another group of babies, they didn't have time. All they did was change them and feed them. The babies just got changed and fed, eventually died. Every one of them. Human touch, human contact, human connection is extraordinarily important in our lives. And of course, we need, of course, that connection with the Lord. He's relational with us. We've been brought into, the Bible tells us in Romans, we brought into this wonderful new relationship with God. You remember the story of the rich man? You can read this in the New Living Translation. Well, it's not a rich man. It's this man in a crowd. And he raises his hand. He says, "Hey, Jesus, tell my brother to share the inheritance with me." Jesus says, "Young man, who made me a judge in your situation?" And then he goes on to tell a story. There was a certain man, and he had everything that he needed. So he thought he'd take it easy. Then he died. And then Jesus said this, "Be careful. A man's life does not consist of his possessions, but rather his rich relationship with God." And that's really true. That life is really, real life is about our relationship with God and our relationship with his people and the people of, you know, our spouse, our children, and the people in our life. And so I want to talk to you about that. Why millennials are so lonely. So we have a few millennials in here. I told you I'm a dinosaur. I don't have a smartphone. I don't carry one. I personally won't. I understand people need them. I understand they can be a great tool. One reason the internet makes us lonely is we attempt to substitute a real relationship with online relationships. Though we temporarily feel better, we are engaged when engaged with others virtually. The connections tend to be superficial and ultimately dissatisfying. Online social contacts are not an effective alternative for offline social interactions, sums up one study. In fact, the very presence of technology can hinder genuine offline connection. Simply having a phone nearby caused pairs of strangers to rate their conversation as less meaningful, their conversation partner is less apathetic, and their new relationship as less close. than strangers with a notebook nearby instead. Excessive internet use also increases feelings of loneliness because it disconnects us from the real world. Research shows that lonely people use the internet to feel totally absorbed online, a state that inevitably subtracts time and energy that could otherwise be spent on social activities and building more fulfilling real offline relationships. In his controversial 1970 book, The Pursuit of Loneliness, sociologist Philip Slater coined the toilet assumption. Our belief that undesirable feelings and social realities will simply disappear if we ignore them. Slater argued that America's individualism, and in turn our loneliness, is rooted in an attempt to deny the reality of human interdependence. The internet is perhaps the best example to date of our futile attempt to flush away loneliness. Amen. 1,000 times Sir Mark Garland. I could not agree more. I see this. What I see happening right before my eyes is cause for extraordinary concern. I was recently getting some dental work done, and the young woman who was helping had been coming to Evergreen many years before, and so she's always happy to see me and calls me by my name, and we were talking, and so she was prepping me, getting me ready. The oral surgeon one isn't in yet, and she said, "Oh, excuse me, I got to return a text." So I'm just, sitting in my chair. She goes, "Oh man, aren't these wonderful?" I said, "I don't know, I don't have one." "What? Are you don't have?" I mean, my husband and I, he's upstairs, I'm downstairs. This is how we communicate. I said, "Well, I feel really badly for you." And she looked at me kind of stunned, so a little bit incredulous, but it was me and I had been her pastor. So she gave me a little grace. That's the sad reality. The average young person today, the average young person sends 150 texts a day. That doesn't include the ones they receive. I was recently with a young man who was sending 9,000 a month. It's totally destroying the fabric of the family. I have parents coming to me. My teenager, they're a Christian family. My teenager is up in his room. After dinner, he goes up in his room. He's on the phone for hours, every night. Hours. Talking here, multiple texting, because you can multiple. You can talk to 22 people at once if you want. You just go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They're mostly girls. So one day he went out with me, and we just talked. And I just listened, and I looked at him. I said, "Tommy, do you mind if I tell you a secret?" He goes, "Yeah, Mark, I really want help." I said, "You're addicted. You're addicted to women through your phone. You're addicted to the strokes that you get through the endorphins that pop into your brain when you read a text and it makes you feel good." I said, "You only have one hope." He said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, you're not going to like it, but I want to help you." He just paid $500 for the latest iPhone. I said, "I want you to take you home, put some goggles on, put it in a plastic bag, and smash it with everything you got with a hammer. You can't have one. You're addicted to it. By the way, the studies show it's worse than crack. It's as bad, not worse, as crack cocaine. It does the same thing to your brain. Now, of course, it's not a drug and what the drug actually does to you physiologically, but what it does to you addicted-wise, it's really dangerous. It's ruining marriages. But I see couples driving down the highway all the time. She's on her phone talking to somebody. He's on his. What? Hello? Hello? What? It's interrupting our conversation. It's interrupting our connections. In fact, I call it a weapon of mass distraction, and that's what it is. Unless you manage it incredibly carefully, unless you put boundaries on your life, you are not going to have a fulfilling, meaningful relationship. So, let me tell you what I'm observing, all right? So, I want to start with a couple cultural observations. Please bear with me, as I think these things have affected just about everybody, and we may not realize it, okay? So, let me make some observations. Some of them might make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. Without realizing it, we have come to like the fake over the real and the genuine. Okay, now that's a pretty bold premise. I'm going to try to prove it to you. Bear with me. We have come to value the fake over what's real and genuine. We see this in the porn epidemic. My son Jeremy, goes in. He's now spoken to 12,000 students in the public school. He's the most requested speaker by kids in the Minneapolis-St. Paul public schools in the greater Twin Cities. He has a film, you can go online and see it. It's called Love, Sex, and Porn. If you enter that, make sure you enter Jeremy Darling or I'll take you to bad places. Love, Sex, and Porn by Jeremy with an O, Jeromy Darling, and you can see the film and what he presents in the school. And it's gutsy and it's bold. And he see porn is destroying. It's destroying our young people. It's the new drug. It's destroying marriages. It's destroying men. It's also destroying many women. You know why? Because we prefer the fake, the instant gratification, over the real, meaningful, yet at times complicated, intimate relationship with our spouse. Sex gets a little complicated. It can be really fulfilling and meaningful, but it's a lot easier to go to the 5 billion women you're carrying around in your pocket that'll do anything for you anytime. And it's a mess. And I tell you right now, this is going to get me in trouble with the kids here. If I was a parent right now and I had a 17-year-old, there'd be no smartphones in my family. There'd be none. You don't need one. You do not need one to function. And I'm proof of that. I'm 61. We need to get a hold of each other. I'll get you a flip phone. They still make it. I'm not opposed to having a phone. But I ain't having no teenager in my house. None of them with a smartphone. The temptations are absolutely overwhelming. Now they're starting to develop some new protections. But that's the first area of fake. Here's the second area of fake. And it's the truth. You can hate me for this. Please don't hate the messenger. Please just think about what I'm telling you. Most Americans prefer fake food. Quick, easy, junk food, pre-boxed, full of bad things, than to spend a little extra time to make something nutritious, valuable, and good for your body. And we are killing ourselves with what we're sticking in our mouth. We have a health crisis in the nation, skyrocketing health costs, because we are lazy and we like junk food. And I don't mean now Twinkies. I'm talking about Hamburger Helper. It's junk food. I'm talking about number one pesticide crops in America, in the world, coffee and apples. Don't eat, get organic coffee, get organic coffee. They're filled with pesticides. You can go to Aldi. Aldi has really, really good prices on this kind of stuff. We do not like, we're often too lazy to even cut up an apple. And we'll reach for this bar, we'll reach for this prepackaged thing. This. And what I'm trying to say to you is, we like fake. Fake is easier than rich. Now we talk about relationships. We see it in an exponential expansion of social media addiction that allows us to have many shallow, superficial friends or shallow, quick conversations rather than deep, meaningful connections to others that are close to us. We spend a lot of time on shallow and relatively a small amount of time on building deeper, more meaningful, emotionally deep, connected relationships. We have been conditioned to value quick, easy, and convenient over more important values. We've been conditioned. We're like Pavlov's dogs. We are the little rat on the wheel, and we're going like crazy, and we wonder, what's happening? I just got off the wheel. I am not going to be connected to the Borg. You know what the Borg is? You ever watch Star Trek The Next Generation? The Borg, right? Plug into the mainframe. I ain't that guy. Yes, I use the internet. Yes, I use email. I have very limited spaces that I go on Google. I do not have... One of the smartest things you do with a smartphone is listen to your pastor's messages or go to strongdisciple.com. But on my computer at home, people have sent me videos and go, Mark, will you watch this? And it's real nice for me. I can write back and say, hey, that was really thoughtful of you, but I can't watch videos on my internet. How come? Because I don't have speakers. I don't have speakers deliberately. I don't need YouTube in my life. I mean, if I want to change an oil filter and I don't know where to find it, it's nice to look at it. There's some value. Please don't get me wrong. There's some value. I go to very limited. I go to about four or five places. My AOL, my Gmail, my Drudge, BibleGateway.com, Craigslist. And that's about the extent of where I allow myself to go. It can just consume your life. Now we've got Hulu, and we've got Netflix, and we've got every old we got every old band that I used to love, and you can sit there and go on and on and on and on. In the meantime, you're a parent. You're a spouse. There's a human being here. There's humans in our world. They need love. They need cared about. They need compassion. And the devil's just wrapping us around his finger. I see this Facebook. I understand why people have it. Almost 65% of the people on it are women. Pinterest is even higher. Girls are very relational. Nothing wrong being relational. But man, it can create so much jealousy, so much anxiety. You see their great vacation. Yours doesn't look like that. People are going in now. Doctors are seeing a spike in plastic surgery because women are very conscious about the selfies on their Facebook. I'd be the first one to admit I have a face made for radio. People have asked me, why don't you make videos, Mark? Two reasons. Because I have a face made for radio. I hate pictures. I've never owned a camera my whole life. That isn't spiritual. I just don't like them. And secondly, I don't want to be one more reason you're sitting around on your rear end watching me. Move. If you're in the car, at least you can listen to a message. You got to drive anyway. Or go out on a walk with me or with one of your pastors and listen to the truth. That's great. Move. But I don't want to be one more contributing reason to the epidemic of sedentary lifestyle that's killing us and shortening our lives. 63% of all diseases in the world are the result of lifestyle decisions. That's mind-boggling. We change the game if we begin to move and we begin to take care of our health physically or what goes in our mouth, and we begin to take care of our relationships, our relationship with God and the people around us. So this stuff is really big stuff to me. I'm talking about, if anyone would listen, if I could do a TED Talk, I could cut billions and billions of dollars that is being wasted from people's lives. I can help you have a better quality of life if we'll step back and be honest about what's really going on. Now, again, I'm going to make this really clear. I don't want you thinking I think you're a bad person because you have a smartphone. Be wise with it. Be honest with yourself about it. Step back. Learn to stick it in airplane mode. Learn to, you know, I mean, it's so, you go to the airport. My wife recently went to the airport. She doesn't get out much, not as much as I do. And she came back after a trip to see her mom in Kansas, and she said, Mark, I'm kind of overwhelmed what I saw. I said, what'd you see? She goes, well, Mark, everybody walking in sitting is looking down. I said, well, what do you mean, honey? Because she goes, well, they have these things in their hand, and they're doing this. I'm sitting on the plane, and it's jam-packed coming out here. I mean, they put us on like sardines. I said to the guy next to me, I said, you know what? You think they'd ever let them get away with this in a building? This would be called a fire hazard. If right now there's a fire, we aren't getting out of here. We're going to burn alive. That's how illegal what they do, but they get away with it, and they cram us on here like we're fish, like we're cattle. You can barely breathe, and the line just keeps coming in. Every single seat on the 737, it was full, and they made them smaller, and we're crammed in there. The full-grown woman over here is watching a little Lego cartoon on her phone. The two adults over here are playing this little bejeweled game, and I'm like, dear God, where have I just landed? In kindergarten, man. What have we become? We don't know how to think anymore. We don't know how to meditate. We don't know how to think deep thoughts. We don't know how to derive. We don't know how to relate. We're just absorbed in the Borg. Now, so I have a friend. By the way, I should say, one of the most frightening articles I read, by frightening in a good way, was written by the guy who invented the like button and developed it for Facebook. He refuses to even allow his children to have smartphones. He quit working for Facebook, and he's trying to get himself unaddicted, and he and his techie buddies get together and talk about the monster that they have created, and they're scared to death for their own children. Because they get together in rooms, and they talk about deliberate ways, through psychological reports, to addict you, and they succeeded. And it was a very long, and I read very long, like, you know, 10-page articles, no little quickie. It was really in-depth. No lying here, no exaggerations. So we got to step back and go, okay, let me reevaluate my life. Let me give you another example of what I see happening, all right? I've done this demonstration, and girls, moms have laughed, but it's true. So I'll show you what I see happening with some of my young mothers. So they got their little yoga pants on, right? At home. Some of them wear in public, but at home. They're comfortable. They stick them on. And they got their little phone right here. They're homeschooling. They got a few kids. Text. Okay, put it back. They're going around. The child needs some attention. Oh, geez. So another text. Okay, who's it coming from? Your 8 sister friends in the Lord. And your sister friends know you got a smartphone. I just texted you. And guess what? If you don't get back to me in about 30 seconds to a minute, now the girl on the other end, who's your sister in the Lord, feels offended and ignored because we have renegotiated relationships. And it's a disaster. And girls are getting into fights, and they're starting to feel, well, why didn't you get back to me? Well, I was in the middle. And then they're missing training opportunities with their children because of this stupid little thing in the rear end of their yoga pants. And I've had girls, they shrink down, and they come up to me later, Mark, you exactly described, that's exactly what's happening with my friends. So recently I was on the phone with a young mom. She said, Mark, I want your advice. I want to know what to do. I want to be an engaged mother. So, and she's a good mom. So I just walked her through kind of humorously this phone, and she goes, "That's exactly me, Mark. And I have some girlfriends that are getting offended at me, sisters in the Lord." And then, of course, you know how drama can be with girls sometimes. Sorry, ladies, but it can get really dramatic. And just like, and you're like, oh my gosh, okay. And she goes, "Mark, so I don't know what to do." So I came up with a wonderful Mark Garling term. We need to help you renegotiate your relationships. And we're going to have an honest conversation. So here's what you need to do. So I describe to her what's happening. You're missing things with your children. So you are parenting while distracted. That's a bad way to mother. You will not succeed. My phone, I tell Kathy, let it ring. I would unplug it from the wall. You are not my personal secretary. My office thought about, you pay attention to the children, sweetheart. You're locked and loaded. You work with the kids. That's your life. That's our world. And then once I got voicemail, just let it answer it. But you do not need to get this phone during these hours. You don't have to get it at all if you don't want to, if I'm not there. So I said, so you're going to need to write to your girlfriends and say an email. It's going to have, "Dear girlfriends, dear sisters in the Lord, I've come to realize lately that I have been parenting while distracted, and it's affecting me. And I'm not blaming any one of you, but I need to renegotiate my relationship and our expectations of one another as sisters. My phone will be off during these hours during the day." Now, here's the other thing, see, that you have to understand is happening. So the sister, I'm walking her through this. She goes, "That's great, Mark. So at 5 o'clock when I turn it on, guess what? I have 55 messages to return." I said, "Guess what? You need to add a little more and let your girlfriends know, no more. I ain't playing that game. I ain't playing that game. You do not have time in your life as a mother of four children to get back to 55 messages. What are we thinking? What are we thinking? We're not. We've got swept into this massive cultural change that just swept us along. And we're like, golly, Jiminy, I'm anxious. I got so much going on. We got to step back and renegotiate it. So if you have to renegotiate it, shut off the text feature. But let your girlfriends know what you're doing so everyone understands. Everyone understands. Say, hey, we can have a phone call once in a while. We'll see each other at small group. But I want you to know I do not have that expectation on you, and you can have that on me because I'm deep into homeschooling with my kids, and I just don't have time to get back to all of these. Because then when I do, studies have proven, actually, believe it or not, you can't multitask. You're lying to yourself. Your brain cannot do two things at the same time. It can't. And texting takes thought. So when you're thought, you become oblivious to, "Knock it off, Johnny. I hate you." Well, probably should have paid attention to that, but you missed it because you're texting. I'm not making this up. I love you. I'm just trying to tell you what I see happening. I see husbands. Husbands, listen. We've always been techie object guys. And your cell phone, I'm just going to be honest, your smartphone is a lot more fun and thrilling and instantly gratifying to hang out with than your three-year-old. It really is. Until you get your brain changed and you're going to have to get rid of, I got to get rid of this addiction somehow, and I got to step back and value real human interaction and spend some time throwing the ball, wrestling around, and then you can get back to your business later. So am I making sense? Are you tracking with me? Hate me, that's okay. Please just think about it because it relates to what we're going to talk about in the church. All right. The Bible commands us to love one another as Christ loved us. Love is one of the central themes of the New Testament. We are commanded to excel still more in our love for each other. In other words, learn to love better. Learn to love more Christ-like. So, how can we grow in loving better in our relationships with each other and those we are close to so we can build better, deeper, more meaningful relationships that honor God and genuinely enrich and bless our lives? Many times we think of love in physical ways, like I can give you a gift or I give you money when someone's going through a financial trial. This is good, and it can really encourage someone, but it's also, bear with me, one of the easier ways to love. As Christians, we are called by God to love one another, to pursue fellowship and companionship with each other. We're designed by God to need one another. We're told by God in Ephesians 4:32, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, and compassionate towards each other. We're to bear each other's burdens. We're to rejoice with those who rejoice. We're to grieve with those who grieve. This is so meaningful in our lives when these things occur in relationship with each other. Some of you may have read this text before. If you go to Colossians chapter, I think it's 3 or 4. Let me grab it here. I have it underlined. I'll give you a little analogy. So I've done a lot of weddings in my life. I don't do too many anymore. Every bride who comes to a wedding, almost all of them I've ever been to come in a wedding dress. Some spend $500, some make their own, some spend $1,000, some spend $10,000. They wear it one time, it goes in the closet, it's never put on again, and often doesn't fit in 5 years. But the point is they never wear it again. You know why? Because wedding clothes is not what you need for marriage. You need marriage clothes. A wedding dress is one thing, but when you get married, you need marriage clothes. Let me tell you what they are. It's right here in the Bible for anybody who wanted to read it. Since God chose you to be his holy, beloved people whom he loves, clothe yourself with tender-hearted compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. You must make allowance for each other's faults and forgive the person who offends you. Remember, the Lord forgave you, so you forgive others. And you must wear the most important piece of clothing is love. Love binds us all together in perfect harmony. These are our clothes for life. These are our marital clothes. These are our parenting clothes. These are our relationship clothes with each other. So as God's dearly loved children, going back to Ephesians, imitate God, clothe yourself with compassion. Compassion. Do you know that's the first thing? I want to talk with you a little bit about what compassion means and what it isn't. I'm going to give you a couple examples. When Jesus was compassionate, it literally means a feeling in your gut that genuinely empathizes and feels for what that person is going through with the desire to help. Let me show you a passage that I'll bet many of us haven't read in a while, maybe never, probably, I don't know if it's ever even got talked about. It's in the book of Hebrews. This is the New Living, chapter 13, verse 3. Don't forget about those in prison, especially, of course, we're talking about Christians who got thrown in prison, or those who are going through great hardship. Suffer with them as though you were there yourself. Share the sorrow of those being mistreated as though you feel their pain in your own body. My gosh, when was the last time you did that with someone? We don't. We would rather be at a party than at a funeral. It's hard to be around sorrow. It's hard to be around people who are grieving. We want to sort of just say a nice word and move on because it's uncomfortable. We are uncomfortable in the presence of Job. We are uncomfortable around people who are like just sort of falling apart because of something they're going through. So Pat said something, you wouldn't have heard him say it. He said it where we were. He didn't even know I was in the room. I wasn't able to come the first day. I was surprised he said it, but I want to pass it on. It's partly why I'm talking with you about this. He was talking about grieve with those who grieve, rejoice with those who rejoice. He was talking a little bit about compassion, empathy. And he said, I've known five people in my life who they just seem to do this naturally. He said, but the person I've experienced the most seeing this is Mark Darling. That surprised me. It's not really a feather in my cap because here's what Pat doesn't know, and he would have known had he been able to be here. I wasn't born this way, and I didn't start out my Christian life this way. I'm going to illustrate it. About 35 years ago, we had a dear pastor who you'd all know if I told you the name, and they lived in Ames. And he and I were getting pretty close. We did a lot of different things together, music and other things. And anyway, he and his wife were expecting their third child. And so one day I called over for some church-related thing, and he didn't answer the phone, and the wife answered the phone. So I'm approximately 24 and a half at the time. And I said, "Oh, hi, Sally. How are you?" She said, "Well, I'm not doing very well, Mark." I said, "I never had a pastor's wife say this." Okay. I'm not doing very well. I just got back from the doctor, and I had to have a DNC. We lost our child. Now, a DNC is like an abortion, less than any Christian woman wants to lose her baby and have it sucked out by a vacuum. That's what a DNC is. Wonderful, wise, mature Mark simply said, "Well, praise the Lord, sister. At least God works all things for good. Just have Dennis call me back later." And I just went on with my day. About 2 hours later, my phone rang, and it was my friend. He said, "Mark, can we talk?" I said, "Sure, what's up?" He goes, "Well, my wife's been crying the last 2 hours, brother." I said, "Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. What happened?" You happened, Mark. I was shocked. I was like, what do you mean? What did I do now? So he walked me through the story, and I was gut shot. Once I got the picture that I didn't have before, I just wept. I mean, I just, well, what a fool. What a fool, you idiot, Mark. I was naive. I was young. I didn't really know what a DNC was. I just, well, you know what was really going through my mind? I'm embarrassed to say this. But this is what we have to confront, these kind of things. I thought, okay, you're just a few months along. You're going to have more. There's lots more eggs. There's lots more chances. Come on. The baby wasn't even out. I didn't say any of that because, of course, I knew, well, that wouldn't be very good. But I just had my magic answer. You know, God will work it for good. I had been through some pain in my life, but I had not been through massive, significant, great quantities of pain. And I didn't really put myself in their shoes. I didn't, now this is a big deal, I didn't stop to put myself in the shoes of a female and imagine what it would be like to have this precious thing growing in my stomach that's a baby that I already love, that just died, and that I humiliatingly had to feel like I had to have it aborted out and wasn't going to pass naturally. That wasn't in my consciousness. It wasn't, I was a little child. I was a boy in a man's body. And I've never forgotten it. I've never forgotten it. Rather than empathize or simply say to that dear sister, "I'm so heartbroken for you. I am sure that just got to feel like a devastating loss," and just listened for more, I didn't. I was uncomfortable. I didn't want to be in that situation. I just wanted to get on with my day. In order to build deeper emotional connections with people that are rich to our soul, our love skills need to be intentionally practiced and developed. They have to be intentionally practiced and developed. We have to make time in our life for these connections and these conversations. So I'm going to give you some advice here today, and then we're going to camp on one in particular. Just bear with me and write these down as we go through. Some of them you've heard before, but in our new modern reality, maybe they'll make some new sense to you. The first thing we have to learn is to be present, not distracted and distant. It's a very good idea to put your phone completely away and turned off. Like, get it away physically from your body. Put it somewhere so it's not, and you're going to have to work. I'm just telling you right now, one of the number one stresses all Americans have admitted they have is text stress, and if their phone goes down or they forget their phone, they get the shakes. I'm not lying. This is the truth. They've done studies on it. We get like, so you're going to have to learn to go, just put that baby away. You got voicemail for a reason. You pay the bill for a reason. Turn the stupid thing off and just go and have a conversation. So let me tell you how this works. Let me give you an example of how all this works in real-time compassion. So one of the things my wife does for me, bless her heart, every day, is she gives me about a 12 to 18-minute massage with this. It's called a percussion massager. We call it a thumper, but it's a two thing, and it goes up and down. So it's just before my nap. I take a nap every day, and I time it 30 minutes. So about 12 minutes is this. So Kathy will rub the middle of my back, the small of my back. I have problems with my calves. She'll rub my calves, the bottom of my feet. She'll dig it into my triceps, and then she rubs my neck. Occasionally, Kathy gets really chatty during these times. And so this is about 2 months ago. So I'm laying down, and I like to hear what's going on with Kathy, so she's rubbing her back. She said, "Mark, did you see the news story today about those little child Muslim brides?" And I said, "I've heard of them before," but I said, "No, honey, I didn't." Now this is going to be a little graphic, kids. I won't get super graphic, but I don't want to scare your daughter. She said, "Well, Mark, one of the child brides was 8 years old, and a 30-year-old Muslim husband took her home and did what you do, and she died." So I'm just listening. I'm just listening. I said, "Oh, that's really tragic, Kathy." She goes, "Mark, it brought back a lot of really bad memories." Now, some of this I know, but anyway, so I said, "Well, this is important." I didn't say, "Oh, well, that's too bad, honey. Hey, can you rub right down there? See? Oh, Mark, he's learned some things." Then I knew, this is kind of important. I can't see your face, but this is kind of important. I said, "Really, honey?" I said, "I'm sorry. Like what?" In other words, I kept the conversation going. I didn't redirect it. She said, "Well, Mark, when I was about 4 or 5, my parents used to go and play bridge over at this family's house. And they'd stay out every Saturday night until like 2 in the morning. So, of course, at about 10, they'd put me to bed up in the couple's bedroom. The couple had two little boys who were about 8 and 9. And at around midnight, and they thought I was asleep, they'd come in and cover my head with a pillow, and they did things to me. And I was like, "Oh, boy." And she said, "Then, Mark, when I was about 8 or 9, we moved to this little town, and some of the neighbor boys would pin me in the garage, and they'd do things to me. And one time my brother came in, and he always hung it over my head. When I threatened to tell him my parents about his drug use, he would threaten me with what he saw happening, but I didn't do anything, and I always felt tremendous shame and guilt. And then, Mark, when I was about 15, I was in high school, and I had, a guy kind of like, we were down by the bleachers in the track, and it was kind of the middle of the day, and he pushed me down on the bleachers and raped me." And then, some of you know the story of what happened with Kathy's parents and our wedding. And then there's been other things you don't know, and I'm not going to get into them today. My wife has dealt with some unbelievable injustices. And things that were done to her during Jessica's illness by hospitals, by people in authority, that you would blow your mind if I told you what happened. And she is one of the most courageous women I know. So I'm taking all of this in. And she's still rubbing my back, and she's just talking. And she moved the thumper, and I stood up, and I said, "Kathy, you absolutely amaze me. I am stunned by the things you've been through, sweetheart. I love you. I treasure you. And I'm so sorry these things happened to your life, and I couldn't be there to stop them, or no one could help you, but even in our marriage, there's been things that have happened by others that I could not stop." So I gave her a hug, and then I kissed her on the cheek, and then I could tell she just wanted to move on. So I got up about 20 minutes later, and I went out to my computer. And she has an iPod. The kid's got an iPad just a couple years ago. She's been introduced now to the world of email and photos of the kids and FaceTime with little grandchildren. I went out and I crafted quite a long email. I enumerated the things she told me. And I said, "Kathy, I want to tell you, I'm absolutely stunned at what you've had to walk through in your life, and yet you are the sweetest, kindest, really, to be honest, most heroic woman I've ever known. I just want you to know I couldn't be prouder to be your husband. I'm so incredibly sorry that you had to go through these things, but it's extraordinary for me to look. There's not a bitter bone in your body. There's not a resentful bone in your body, and I can't hold the candle. to the godliness that I see in your life. I'm humbled to be your husband. Anyway, there was other things that I wrote. So about 50, I sent it. I knew she was sitting up in a different room. And sometimes I write these kind of things, these kind of praiseworthy things out because I wanted to be able to save them, you know, to see them. Because sometimes words, they get said to you, but you forget. Did they really say that? Was it really that good? You kind of forget it. So I went in about 15 minutes later and I called up. I said, honey, you okay? And I could hear she's kind of crying. And I said, are you all right? She goes, oh, Mark, I'm all right. She said, I just finished reading this 6 times. It means so much to me. That's what can happen in a marriage. See, it's what can happen in our relationships when we take the time to listen with our heart, to notice, to observe, to put myself in her shoes, what she went through. See, I had something happen to me when I was a kid. I've really not talked much about it because as a male, it was incredibly humiliating. So you have to understand a little background. So I have a father who is, he used to still mess with my dad. Like when my dad was 16, he lied to the railroad, told him he was 18, he was working on the railroad. So this is my father, okay? So my dad was blonde and gorgeous. I don't know how else to put it. He's just gorgeous and really built. He had so many fights by then. So he worked with a bunch of really rough guys on the railroad, laying track, like really lifting up the iron with the old things, lifting up the big rails, pounding them. That's what he did. So the foreman really liked him. He called him Mike. My dad's nickname was Mike. And one day the foreman had to leave, and he said, now look, Mike, he said, these guys today, the guys that work, they hate you. He said, and a lot of them are cons, and they're rough. He said, so if any of them bother you, I want you to take this pickaxe and break it over their head. And my dad, his dad died when he was 6. He was basically a street hood much of his life. He said, okay. So as soon as he left, he got surrounded by about 10 guys. And they're starting to push and say a bunch of verbal things. And the biggest guy was coming at my dad. My dad just reached down, picked the pickaxe, crushed his skull right over the head, right over the head, broke it open, bleeding everywhere. The rest of the guys ran. That's the kind of father I had. My father had a killer instinct. I never had it. I love boxing, but I don't have my dad's killer instinct. My dad had 117 knockouts. When you see a guy hurt, you know, my tendency is, okay, back off. If you're going to be an effective UFC fighter or boxer, you have to have a killer instinct. You have to finish. Do you follow what I'm saying? You understand that? So I looked up to my dad. I really admired my dad. But I knew if my dad told my dad I got picked on in school, you know what my dad would say? Knock their face in, son. And though I'm aggressive and I wrestle and I've done stuff, I don't have that in me. And I knew I could get in a lot of trouble. So when I was in 7th grade, I was a really fast runner. And at that time, O.J. Simpson was the Heisman Trophy winner. I loved football, and I was a halfback, and I scored often. In fact, the coach put me in against the 8th graders, and they got really angry because I could get around the end, and then they looked bad. So one day, and they always used to tell me, and darling, when you get to high school, we murder freshmen. And I knew what they meant, and I'm going to describe in a moment. So now I'm 7th grade, one day, my best friend, his name was Mickey, he was the quarterback, I was a halfback, and we were down on the track by the high jump, you know, where you jump over and there's that big foam thing. It was covered in blue then, those days. So we were messing around, and the girls were at the other end. And the 8th grade boys, they came down, about 20 of them, they surrounded us. They took my friend's pants, took his jock, and forced him to try to masturbate, and then they took me and tied me up my jock and left us there. They took one of my best friends in 8th grade, and they covered his entire body in atomic bomb. It's this thing for analgesic for sore muscles. They put it all over him, his groin. They taped him up, hung him in a locker. They had to rush him to the hospital. He had a reaction to hives, and he almost died. That's the kind of school I went to. I was frightened every single day I went to school until my 11th grade. In 11th grade, I was in, actually it was 10th. I had this phys ed teacher, Mr. Rieslin. He was huge. He could do 101-arm push-ups. And his son was my best friend. His name was Sonny. And but the thing I hated most about school was the locker room. See, I knew even before I became a Christian, I would never, this is strong, please don't hate me for saying this, this is a Mark Darling adjective, I will never send my kids to the concentration camps of America. I won't do it. I despised school that much. I hated it. every moment of every day. I hated it. So you go in, you know, and I'd have my clothes so I could get out of the shower and quick get in my clothes because the seniors and the juniors, they do a lot of crap. One of the things they like to do is snap people with a wet towel. And it's really painful. So I'm coming out, and I hear him snap the towel, and it was really loud. My teacher came out with a wiffle ball bat. I don't know if you ever been hit with a wiffle ball bat. And there's metal lockers in the room. No one knows. We don't see him. We're all trying to get dressed. He walks in. Bam! Bash, you thought a bomb went off. We all jump like scream. And he goes, and he was not usually a foul language man. He goes, I want to know right now who the blankety son of a blank was that snapped that towel. No one said a word. He said, I don't expect you would, you coward. But he said, I'll tell you right now, I've had to rush more than one young man to the hospital with skin taken right out of his body because of a towel. If I ever catch one of you do this, I will bend you over and smack you with this wiffle ball bat. And I was sitting there for the first time in my life going, someone finally stood up, a teacher in authority for all of us guys who got picked on all the time. That's the first time I felt safe. From then on, I kind of grew up a little more, and people didn't mess with me my junior and senior year. I had really long hair. I looked kind of mean, and I decided I'm not taking this crap anymore from people. And then I got out of that town. The day after I graduated, I left and hitchhiked to here. I understand what it's like to be shamed and humiliated. I've had it happen as a pastor. And so it empowers me when I'm dealing with other people. It empowers me to take the time to listen to what they're going through. And I want to tell you, I'm going to give you some examples tomorrow, but this example is spread to my children. I'm going to share with you some examples tomorrow as we talk about compassion toward the lost, grace and compassion towards lost people, how that works in real life. And I've seen my kids do things, my son, my daughter. I'm like, I just sit back and it makes me cry. I think, Lord, I'm so proud of their heart and their compassion for broken human beings. And I'll share some of that with you tomorrow. We've got to learn to be present, to be attentive, and this is number two, and make eye contact and listen with your ears, your heart, your emotions, and your mind. I had a young lady begin to come to my church. She since married, and she and her husband moved to another state. When she was 3 years old, her mother used to drop them off at the grandmother's, and they'd help the grandmother roll cigarettes, and the mother would reward them with a Dixie cup full of Jack Daniels. 3 years old. She saw her mom. Her mom would bring home different men about every other week. She had an incredibly difficult life. She dealt with inter-family sexual abuse. It was very, very, very difficult. I remember when she first came to my church the first night. I don't know if you've ever seen a whipped dog at a humane society. When you go up to them, they cower. They kind of whimper, and they don't usually bare their teeth. They're kind of afraid. And so I remember I walked up to say hello, because I always try to walk up to every new person. And she wouldn't look me in the eye. She just looked at the ground. And she kind of told me her name, and I said, very gently, I said, well, it's very nice to have you tonight. And I could tell right then, I could just tell, this girl is incredibly insecure. She's probably had incredibly difficult things happen. Tread very carefully, Mark. So I invited her back the next week. She came and came the next week, and we'll just call her Sally. I said, Sally, if you'd ever like to talk or you want somebody to listen, feel free. Here's my email. You can write to me, and I'm a great listener. I would love to read the story of your life if you ever want to share with me your story. That means a big deal to people that you want to take the time. I have written over 100,000 emails since I got email. When I die, there's going to be email, little epistles all over the place of things I crafted to help a person through. And I'll listen. And sometimes writing, see, this is what I know. It's a secret. Writing is a great therapy. It's a great therapy to put down on paper. Maybe you've never told somebody what actually happened to you. So she began to write. I think I have over 100 emails back and forth. Well, I would just listen. I would console. I would empathize. And I know she came to see me as a father she never had. And that's happened often with young people because I get very emotional if I start to talk about how broken this generation is. Fatherlessness is the number one number one societal problem that we have. Barring people, everybody needing Jesus. Barring that one, fatherlessness, two ways. Absent fathers and fathers who are there but are gone emotionally. They're emotionally, many of you had a father, he was not emotionally engaged in your life. And it's tragic because you're sitting there longing. You're starving like a sponge. Do you remember the picture? I wish I could show it right now. I wish my mind, you could get on the screen what I see. Saw Gladiator? How many of you saw Gladiator? Okay? And you've got Commodus, the idiot, the moron, the filthy, vile, immoral piece of garbage. But there's one very telling moment when Richard Harrison, they're in the tent, and he says, Father, I would have given 1,000 whatever to have had the sunshine of your affection, of your attention, but I knew nothing I ever did would be good enough. And his father then gets down on his knee and says, Son, your failure as a son is my failure as a father. And I saw that man and I just started to sob because so many young people, that's the reality of their life. See, let me explain something to you. You've got to understand this. When a child grows in the womb, there are absolutely timed things that happen chemically to produce that child. Did you know that? They have to happen. It's called gestation. And they have to happen at a certain time in a certain sequence. What no one's talked about is once you're out of the womb, there are things meant to happen in the cellular structure of the family that were supposed to be given to you, or you grow up socially retarded. You grow up emotionally incomplete because you didn't get them at the right time. And especially happens with your father. And so I'm dealing with a lot of socially broken people. I'm dealing with people who are a 20-year-old, but they're a 6-year-old in a 20-year-old body. They don't understand how to look in the eye. They don't have the confidence to shake your hand. They don't have any self-confidence because the man in their life who is meant to be strong and secure and wrap them up in their arms and speak into their life and guide them and give them lots of words of encouragement was never there. Do you follow me? And it is the number one reason we have a broken African-American community in this nation. Number one reason is fatherlessness. We have more whites that are fatherless, but as a percentage, it's far higher in our black community. And it's heartbreaking. One time, let me show you how this works. So I'm going to get back to this girl in a minute. So we had, you know, these shootings with the cops and blacks recently. And anyone that happens, of course, it's going to be this big, almost semi-riot. My son's wife's sister is a Minneapolis cop in the roughest area of the city. She's blonde, Swedish, in the roughest part of North Minneapolis. So I'm on both sides. I understand, but I'm going to get to this. So right after we had the Philando Castile shooting in Minneapolis, I was headed to Trader Joe's. It was a Saturday morning, and I went real early on purpose because if you have to go, by the way, feel free to go. I'm sorry. I'm going a little over. Hope you bear with me. There's a black man there who I've gotten to know. I've seen him a couple times, and I've been very complimentary to him because he works really hard. And so I'll call him Jamal. That's not his name. But so I went right into his section, and I could tell he was there, and no one else was in this area of the store. And I walked right over, and I just said, hey, Jamal. I said, I've been thinking about you the last 2 days, and I've been praying for you. I said, how are you? I realize this is a very hard time right now in your community. And this big guy's bigger than me. He started crying. He goes, who are you, man? Who are you? He goes, Mark, what the hell? What are we just fodder? What do I tell my kids? So this is a guy. And so I know this. This I know. I know he's never had a father in his life. He's never told me that. So he said, Mark, I don't know what to tell him. I said, Jamal. I said it with real tenderness, and I was a little emotional. I said, I want to tell you, you're giving them the greatest gift you can give them every day. You're showing up every day. You have one of the best attitudes I have ever seen an employee have, and you're in here working hard, and you're trying to give them something that I know you did not have. And he started to sob, and he goes, can I hug you? And I said, absolutely. He stepped back, and he goes, man. He goes, whoa, I just felt like electricity in my body. Now, of course, black people tend to be a little more expressive than white people. So, but But it was. It was a new, unique moment. He goes, who are you? I said, well, I'm a pastor, Jamal. He goes, I knew there was something going on, man. I said, he said, how did you know I don't have a father? I said, it was just a safe guess. And I wanted you to know, I'm a dad and I'm a grandfather. And I work with young men, and I cannot commend you enough for showing up every single day with your attitude to go home and love on your children and give them a better life than you had. You deserve a medal, and I am proud of you. And if you ever need help, you call me. He went hug me again, and he's crying. You know, people are starting to stand around. I don't care. Who cares? This is a moment. This guy is going through tough stuff, and I wanted to put wind in his sail. Now, brother and sister, that's the Jesus I know. So we're back to this girl. Quick example. Then we're gonna have to end. I have so many other things here to get to. This girl was a horse girl. When I was a kid, I always wanted a horse. Never got to have one. That's okay. But I love horses. I kind of wish we still used them, but I love horses. And horses are different than dogs. So you'll understand this when I share this. So one morning she wrote me, she said, Mark, I'm just kind of beside myself. I'm feeling tremendous anger, frustration, so much grief. She said, here's why. My horse, Jericho, just died of thrush. I think it's called thrush. And I told my friends, and they're just kind of like, treating it like, you know, it was a kitten, or it you know, well, okay, let's move on. Move on. I'm devastated, Mark, and none of my friends understand. So I wrote back. Dear Catherine, I am extremely sorry that you lost that precious friend. I said, there is no question it's one of the most devastating losses of your life. Because I know that after you were raped and after your brother molested you, the only refuge you had was the back of your horse. And when you're riding your horse on the property your family owned, you told that horse everything, because that's what we do with a horse. And that was probably the safest companion you've ever had in your life. And I want you to know, I get it, and I'm really sorry. She wrote me back. Unbelievable, Mark. I cannot believe you knew that. It's like you read my mind. Like, that's the truth. It was the only friend I had in my life. And he's gone. I knew. How did I know? Because I'm Magic Man? Because I'm the Wizard of Oz? No. Because I've trained my intuition. I've trained myself to go, what would this be like to have been this girl, to have had these things happen, and not have a father you could talk to, or a friend you could talk to, or a teacher you could talk to? Who would it be? It would be my horse. I watched it in all the old John Wayne movies. I watched it in Roy Rogers. I watched it in My Friend Flicka. You talk to your horse. You go sit in the barn. You talk to yours. It's different than a dog. They're different. They're different. I knew that. Compassion in action is so powerful. And it ministers to people's souls. It ministers when they feel like there's another human being in the world who gets me. I have spent most of my life with nobody getting me. That's why God means so much to me. I closed recently with a story. I have a dear friend, pastor. Lives in another state. He's younger. He could be my son. I think of him that way. We're very close. Never got to spend much time together. But about a year and a half ago, he's going through something unbelievable. One day I answered the phone, and it was just sobbing. It was just sobbing. And I looked at the number, so I knew. I said, Tommy, what's wrong, man? He goes, I just want to die, man. I'm so sick of this. And he just went off. And he knows he can say anything to me. You can say anything to me. Use any word you want to use. I don't care. I understand pain. I understand human emotion. And he just went on. And I feel my life's threatened. My family's threatened. My whole life just feels like it's going down. People get together. They have a hate club for me, Mark. A hate Tommy club. I'm about the only other person I know who's had that. I think that's why his friends told him to call me. So we talked, I listened. Well, we talked, we ended up talking about every day for the next 2 weeks. He has since written me and told me, Mark, you saved my life. I feel like you're the one person in the world, the way you're wired. You'd actually get me. You'd actually understand. I understood, man. He was going through hell. Now he's in a much different place now. He was ready to walk away from ministry. He was ready to quit. He's and I love him dearly, and he knows that. He said, Mark, I knew I could just emote. I knew you would try to understand, and I prayed for him. I got him through, and I mean, I really did. There's a lot of things I could tell you about the story. I just won't. Are you the kind of person? Will you choose to be the kind of person that people can be honest with and real with and just walk with them through life? Because it's hard. Things are going to happen. I want to share one last thing with you, and then I got to let you go. I don't want to let you go, but I'll let you go. One of the things that gets in the way of our compassion is judgment. We make judgments on people privately as they're talking. So you know when it says share the joys of others when they come to you? So I've had this happen one time. A person came to me and said, oh, Mark, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. So what's going on? I just got a boat. I got the boat I always wanted. And emotionally, I'm kind of stopped dead in my tracks. Why? What a waste of money. What a stupid thing to do with the Lord's money. I mean, a boat. A boat? Who wants a boat? And don't you realize that someday you're going to need to retire and you should have probably saved that $10,000? That's what can go through the Mark Darling mind. Rather than, wow, I'm really happy for you. My instant reaction inside, and so it deadens my response, is, well, that was really a dumb economic decision. Or let's go the other way. Someone comes and shares with you some pain. And instead of sharing the story, your little antennas are up and you're thinking, you idiot. If you had not made that decision, you would not be in this pain right now. And it dampens our Jesusness of just walking with them in the moment of the reality of what life and maybe some of their decision has brought to them and sharing it. Does that make sense? Okay, I got to stop. There's so many things I'd like to give to you this morning, but we got to have your lunch break, and I got to go lay down, and then we'll be back here at 1:30. Is that right? It's 1:30? Yep. Okay. Thank you for bearing with me. If you go to my website, strongdisciple.com, I did this message. It's called Loving Better, and there's a letter that I read from a black sister in my church that I would love for you to hear this to understand some of our black brothers and sisters' experience of life. It's vastly different than yours, and it would be good to understand it and see it. And so I don't have time to read it or comment on it. The Lord brought other stories to mind. So let's pray, okay? Father, I just want to thank you today. I want to thank you, Lord, for helping me feel. I want to thank you, Lord, for helping me through the pains of my life, and that through the pain of my life and comfort that you've brought, that you've expanded my compassion muscle, and that you've taught me more and more what it means to empathize with others. Help us, Lord. It's so rich. It's so rich to walk with one another through the sorrows of our life, through the joys of our life, and really share them. And really be engaged with one another. Bless these dear believers. Strengthen them this afternoon over lunch in Jesus' name.